If Murray had supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
Sending out good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes.
108 breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grind America Show, coming at you this week, a day late, maybe you noticed, because Grandma's on the road. Grandma's back out on the Sunshine Coast, visiting the family, doing some painting. It's always fucking raining out there. That's the thing. I mean, that's the thing about
it. No, it's super gray.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine. Right now, it's like just... When where you are and I am, you just get so used to the, you take the sun for granted. When it's not sunny, I'm like, what the fuck?
Totally. I know. Totally. It's so gray here, like rainy, gray, overcast, dark. Yeah. But I mean, it's still beautiful on the water here. So yeah,
we average over 300 days of sunshine a year here where I am.
Yeah.
And then the further east.
Well, the other thing is I was driving too. I was driving too, and like seeing the little strip of the sky, like looking for the sky, and there's no sky. There's no sky here. Like you're in these like, you know, roads where there's no sky, except for, you know, when you're looking out over the ocean, of course, there's a bit, but compared to the prairies, you just get used to that big sky too. It's so different.
Oh, dude, by the time you leave there, you'll probably even be a little claustrophobic. Like you won't notice it. So you're not going to notice it till you get back. But when I went to England for a week, I came back and it was like, as soon as I got out of the airport, you know, you go through the tunnel and come up the hill there and it's just, open, and I could see the whole sky and I was like, oh man, I feel so free. I couldn't, I was like, I miss this more than I even fucking realized. I didn't realize that I felt off without being able to just see things coming.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's interesting.
It just goes on forever. I mean, I was hunting geese this weekend in a field that was 5 miles by 5 miles, what's that? 25 square miles, one solid wheat field without a single road through it or anything. This is the Hutterites, right? Out on the Hutterite. Yeah. I made friends with some Hutterites. I got to say, this goose hunting is a new level of meeting farmers, because they're always in the wheat. So it's like, we'll go out, we'll watch the lake, we'll wait to see where the goose go. And then we just go bang on a door. Or sometimes you can use a landowner map and Google and get a phone number or something like that. But I'm meeting a lot of good old boys.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
And we got caught in a blizzard. So it took me, dude, I got to tell you, I left here at five in the morning. No. Yeah. I left here at 5:50 to go to Brooks, and I woke up, I look out and there's 4 inches of snow. I'm like, huh, this is a bad idea. Cause when I went to bed, it was pouring rain. And then I woke up and there's 4 inches of snow. I'm like, ah, you know, you're jacked. It's like opening day almost. So we go out, I start driving, I get out of Strathmore. Oh, I'm not supposed to say the town. Well, the town's on the P.O. box, so I don't live in the town. Anyway. So I start driving down the highway, and it's like, dude, I get up to like 90, and the truck just like, ew. So it's like glare ice.
I'm doing
70 all the way to Brooks on a Wednesday morning cruising along, and I went by like, the first transport was jackknifed in the ditch. It was like one of those triple trailer dealies. And then I went by about 10 more trucks in the ditch. And I didn't
stop. Like trucks, like semis? Semis?
Yeah, only semis. Only Simmons. Wow, the only cars that came in the ditch was Simmons.
What?
Yeah. And, you know, they say we have a truck driving problem here right now that I'm not going to get into on this show. People can check out the alist.ca if they want to hear me talk about that kind of stuff. But we have a bunch of new truck drivers that, you know, don't do a lot of wintering. So I'm assuming that's part of the problem. And then, you know, after that, it was just transports parked on the side of the highway for miles. I must have drove by 200 transport trucks that had just driven by all the other ones in the ditch and chickened out at various stages. Because you know how to you can tell when you get into the big gullies, because you'll be going flat and you'll get into the big gullies where they're just like a huge ravine. Coulee, I guess, would be the technical term. Or maybe a canyon, because there's a little bit of water at the bottom of some of them. But whenever you go down to those, you know it's going to be icy. So. Anyway, I got out there, because usually in Brooks, there's less snow. So I get out there, and it's, and then, so I get half an hour to Strathmore, and it clears up a bit. It's not snowing, it's not raining, the roads are pretty nice. I look over in the fields, it's just like a dusting of snow, they're not full of snow. Like, this could be okay. And then we get to the hunting field to meet Jesse, and it is a fucking onslaught, dude. It is like there's 6 inches of snow. It's snowing like crazy. What do? We drag the shit out anyway. We're like, fuck it, we'll go. So we drag all our decoys and our blinds, two trips out, probably a mile and a half into the field through the snow, and lying in the snow for like an hour and a half, and dragged it all back. And then then I went out, dude. I was out yesterday. It was, or not yesterday, it wasn't the nicest.
So you're not getting, did you not get any in the snow then? You didn't get any?
We didn't get any in the snow. No, we gave up. Wow. We gave up probably a little early because we didn't even get any action. Nothing was flying over. And it was like, we're lying in the snow. It's literally a blizzard. So my face started to hurt because it wasn't that cold. You know, it's not freezing cold. Yeah. It's only water, just below freezing. But the frozen rain was just pelting off my face, just constantly, just tick,
tick, tick. Yeah.
And it just got to you after a while. And then so we packed all the stuff, we drag it all back to the truck through the snow. And just as we're at the truck, we unload the guns, we crank up some tunes, or having a time. And these fucking geese seem to like come into the loud music of the truck, and they fly over the like 10 yards, a whole flock. But none of the guns are loaded. And then I use a Bluetooth speaker because you're allowed to electronically call snow geese. It's the only wild game you're allowed to use an electronic call for, unless it's a pest control like coyotes and stuff. So I bring that with me to make goose sounds, put them in the decoys while we're hunting. Because we didn't shoot anything all fucking weekend. I spent tons of hours scouting, tons of hours in the field. And we got with, you know, the whole flock lands a half a mile away from us. We can see them all, can't shoot them. So I don't know. It's just a lesson. We're just gonna keep trying. Got to keep trying. This is all new for me, this goose hunting, and it's hard.
Yeah.
There's so many of them. Yeah. So we didn't end up. But anyway, so we're walking back to the truck at the end of the day, Sunday night, before we went back out Monday morning. And I'm just like, so we're walking back. So I have a Bluetooth speaker. So I just start cranking some tunes. Start cranking some Nirvana. What happens? Fucking flock of geese flies like 20 yards over our head. So I don't know. The next time I go out, we might just play some tunes instead of goose sound and see if that brings them in.
Yeah, there you go. Make sure it's 90 grunge, you know?
90s grunge. Yeah, it could be 90. I thought it was country the first time. It might have been Hank Williams, the first group. But anyway, that's what I've been up to. I hunted all weekend, basically, and have nothing to show for it, so. The spring hunt is my first spring hunt, and it is proving to be, because here's the thing, when we do the fall hunt, we're like, you know, I'm in Canada, so we're like the first people on these birds in the fall. They come from the Arctic, they go over Edmonton. That's really the only hunters they see is Edmonton, then me. And now this time, I mean, these geese have been getting shot at for basically the last 3 months straight down in the States. I think their season opens in January.
Yeah.
And in the States, they call the snow goose season in the spring, they call it the conservation season. So you're allowed to just like, you don't have to have a plug in your shotgun. You're allowed to have like 20 shells in your shotgun if you want. There's not really a limit. There's so many of these birds. It's great. Dude, have you seen how many birds? I've probably seen a 250,000. I would say at least 100,000 birds on one lake on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
is the most birds I've ever seen in one place in my life. It is fucking crazy. They take off and then turn into this big tornado, like a tornado of geese that you can't even see through. You can't even see through the thing. It's like, I never seen anything like it. I seen that shit Saturday, me and Miles, and I was just like, holy fuck, man. And then I had the video camera with me too, but I was just like, I was so caught up in the moment that I didn't film it. So one day I'll get some footage of it.
Anyway. Similar to what happens when you watch a UFO. When you see a UFO, you get so caught up in the moment, you don't film it. So now you know what I'm. Now you know what I when I have an argument and you make fun of me. Now you know.
Do I? That's the argument. Yeah. I guess I'll give it to you. Yeah. I'll give it to you. You can have the argument. So we're getting speaking of UFOs and Big Sky. There's probably not much bigger sky than on a 13 square mile island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, huh?
Right.
Looks like we're going to do the Easter Island thing, folks, next March. Next March, 18th to 25th, 2026. So you can watch for that to go on sale soon. But I got to say, I put out sort of a feeler to our insiders, If you're part of that Contact at the Cabin mailing list, if you sign up for that thing, then you get the first chance. Because when this goes on sale, those people will get a couple week head start to get tickets or get a deposit in. And from that list, we already have like, oh, I think 14 people that said they plan to buy tickets.
Yeah. Right?
And I don't think we'll
do there's more. Not going to be a lot. I mean, there's not going to be a lot going, right? This is a short group, right? A small group, right? So there's not going to be a lot there. It's very limited seating on this one. A
couple dozens. Same as Azores. 24 is at the top number. So that's going to go quick. I would say that all the people that have emailed me so far are very serious people who have come to our other events. So we'll have that up for sale right away. We're going to include the flight. So you don't even have to worry about flying all the way there. I'm going to book all the flights from Santiago, Chile. So we'll just get to Santiago. We'll all stay in the airport hotel there overnight. And then the next day, we'll get on the flight out to Easter Island, to Rapa Nui, where we'll stay. I'm working out the itinerary with the guy right now. But basically, we'll see everything. We'll see everything that Easter Island has to offer. And there's a couple, 3 or 4 hour hikes that will be guided as well, that people can do or not do, depending on their hiking capacity. I know some of the hikes are up to 4 hours. So that'll be optional. I mean, the cool thing about Easter Island is it's small, so we don't. It's not as much scrambling around as some of the events that we do. It's more like, leave at 10, go out into the field, sort of, short drives and a lot of walking and a lot of cool stuff to see. We're doing the astronomy night, so we're doing the stargazing night where we'll go out and look at the Milky Way and the sunrise at the whatever it's called, that where all the statues are in a row there. We're going to do sunrise there probably on.
And that'll be like on the equinox, right?
Is it on the equinox?
It can be on the equinox. We are there. We must be there during the equinox. So, I mean, how do people reserve a spot before it goes on sale? Can they email me at graham@grahamerica.com to.
They can. Yeah. Like, a spot? Yeah. 14 spots.
Or
me, DarrenEckerAmerica.com. It works. So we've already got 14 people on the list, and it's going to cap out at 24. Like I said, we're going to include everything like we always do. So we're going to include all the meals, lodging, and the flights. We're actually going to include the flights from Santiago because there's only one flight a day, and I don't want get that getting messed up. It seems to just make sense for us to include that. So we'll do that. I already checked, and there's not like a, if you want a first class ticket, you can't get one. So it's just like, there's one plane that goes there and back each day, and that's it. I believe that's the only place you can fly there from, because you can't do customs there. So you have to already be into Chile before you go back. So even if you're coming from Australia or someplace, you got to go to Chile first to get let into the country. So then you can come back to Rapa Nui. So we're going to do that. We're going to include everything, including that flight. And it's looking like it's going to come in around $4,900 for a standard and and just over $6,000 for a private. The hotels are not cheap, but they are nice. They are quite nice. And like I say, we include everything on that. And it's a trip of a lifetime. Like I say, we're including that flight adds $1,000 basically to it almost. I think it's 800. So
Yeah.
So let us know. Email Graham, email me. There's 14 gone. There's 10 spots left. It's gonna actually go up for I'll put it up and it'll be the tickets will be hidden for the first 2 weeks, which the code to unhide the tickets will be emailed out to everybody that's on that mailing list from contact@thecabin.com. And hey, it's a year away. That sounds like a lot of money. You make the deposit today and you can make payments for a year and have that thing paid off by the time we go. I think I'm going to ask for all the money by like January 1st.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
90 days before. So check it out. Get in touch. If it's something you want to do, get in touch sooner than later, because it's going to be first come, first serve. And like I say, we're over halfway on, you know, a couple people might drop off, but these are people that have come to Egypt and to other places with us that I would be surprised if they didn't come to this one.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I do have Jim Davis to thank. He supported us with the 1080. Other than that, I don't think we got any other new action this week. So I think we went a whole week.
I'll have some emails. I think I'll have some emails to read, but I'll read them next week.
I lied. We got 2222 from Fisk Denovan. Came in with 2222. So we thank.
Thanks, Fisk. That's awesome.
Thanks, Fisk. We appreciate that. Of course, head over to grahamamerica.ca/support today. Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation. Of course, Graham and I will both be at Cosmic Summit this year. If you want to come and hang out, you can use code GrabAmerica25 to get a deal over there. And Graham probably got to go to dinner right away. Should we get out of here?
Yeah. This is I do. They're waiting for me. So, this is amazing app though, man. This is an amazing app with. Yeah, because we got to have him on again. He's like one of the OGs in Cymatics and stuff, man. I mean, it's unbelievable. So I'm just pulling up his
dude. We got to go to Egypt here, but
I mean, his experience in the Great Pyramid is mind blowing.
Oh my god, I need to know if that's I need to know. Right. Yeah.
So John is an internationally renowned acoustics scientist and inventor of the cymoscope, a scientific instrument that makes sound and vibration visible and is used in fields like acoustics, music therapy, and consciousness studies to explore the relationship between sound, form, and healing. Sound and light have been used for healing since ancient times, but only recently has modern science begun to catch up with what the mystics and healers have known for centuries. Everything in the universe is energy, and energy can be shaped, transformed, and directed toward healing. This isn't woo, it's science, the study of cymatics, the science of making sound visible. So yeah, this is fantastic. And also check out frequencymedicinecourse.com. There's a course that they're offering as well, and that is at soundmadevisible.com, where you can find his website there. So
there you have it. And he did mention that he had a great time and would come back anytime. He sent an email out afterwards.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. It's fantastic.
So support the show, please. We need your support now more than ever. GrahamAmerica.ca/support. Sign up for monthly or make a one-time donation today. Hey, if you want to hear Graham contemplate drinking piss, check out our other show, GrahamAmericaOutlaw.ca. We just have Jonathan Otto on there. If you watch the video,
my pee.
If you watch the video,
not like just in John,
you could watch John drink his piss on the show. So I think that's a first.
I know, but I'm telling you, like I'm contemplating my own, not somebody else's. Just so you know, like,
I think we all got that.
It's not about the water sports. It's about my own cells. It's about my own stem cells.
But the stem cells. Did you try yet? Did you try yet?
No, not yet.
I don't believe
you. No, not yet. I'm still psyching myself up.
Okay. All right, guys. Enjoy the chat with John Stewart Reed.
John Stewart Reed, thanks for joining us in Grimerica. This is going to be very fun. We're excited to have you. I can't believe we haven't had you on yet, but welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm absolutely delighted to be with you.
Yeah, this is, you're one of the OGs, like one of the original Cymatics guys. I mean, and we've talked about it over the years. And of course, it's been gaining so much ground. So it's going to be fascinating to talk to you about this.
Yes, Cymatics for sure is one of my very favorite subjects. So I'm really looking forward to chatting with you about that.
Yeah. How do you feel that it's been? I mean, it really has kind of reached a crescendo, I would say, like the main sort of like got mainstream attention. And I was reading these books from the early 1900s, the late 1800s, and I couldn't believe they were talking about it back then. I always thought it was kind of a new phenomenon. But or newly recognized phenomena, but I mean, it's been around for a while. But you've been into this for decades. So what does it feel like to have it? Basically, everybody's heard of it at this point. You know, it's really come into the mainstream.
I'm excited about it because, as you say, you know, it's been around for a long time, but it's reached a kind of tipping point now. So everyone and their granny seems to be talking about Cymatics, and it's a wonderful science. And actually, last year, just in October last year, I was at the Water Conference. I'd been invited to give another presentation. You probably know it's a wonderful conference in which they talk about water, but it sounds like a boring situation. It's not. It's really fascinating. So much is not known about water. But in this particular instance, the reason that I was invited was because the Cymoscope instrument, by the way, you see an iteration of it right behind me here. This is the new portable model. Anyway, the Cymoscope instrument uses nothing but pure water, and the purer the better. So that's why I was there. And I actually gave a presentation on my four postulated laws of cymatics. These have been coming along for a long, long time. So I've been working in this field for over 25 years. And so, you know, throughout that time, these laws, as I now call them, postulated laws anyway, have been emerging slowly but surely. And so I was very honored to be able to present them to a bunch of scientists at the Water Conference. They were very well received. The most exciting thing about these laws is how they play out in our biology. You know, obviously, from a scientific viewpoint, they're interesting, but I'm much more interested in how they play out in everyone's body.
Well, what are the four laws?
Well, that would be that's a really big topic to get into. But one of the laws that I think would be perhaps most interesting to your viewers and listeners would be the second law of cymatics, which talks about the compression ratio of sound when it enters into water. You know, I think it's pretty common knowledge that sound travels much faster in water, right? However, the reason for that is simply because the water molecules are much closer together than air molecules, right? Or air atoms or molecules. So when sound has certain wavelengths, let's call them, in air, they're not really waves at all, but I can come back to that point. But anyway, we call them wavelengths of sound. When those wavelengths of sound enter into water, so they go from air into water, they are compressed by a ratio of 829 times to one. And this is simply the literally the distance or the difference in distance between the water molecules and the air molecules, right? So they get compressed in that ratio. And as I mentioned, you know, it's exciting to be able to then look at these laws and see how they play out in our biology. And one of them, the second law, relates to when sound enters into our body, how it's compressed in that ratio. Now, one of the areas of your body that you might not think about in terms of how sound affects it is your eyes, or are your eyes, right? Because your eyes, of course, are filled with water. It's almost, well, it's not pure water, but it's a certainly a very good version of water that's in your eyes. And what happens is when sound enters into your eyes, of course, it's compressed. The ratio is compressed 829 times. So all of these long wavelengths of sound suddenly become compressed in that ratio. Why is this interesting? Well, it's interesting because of the pineal gland. Now, the pineal gland is this little, weeny little pine-shaped cone, it's like a pine cone, basically. It's tiny little, and it has beautiful striations on its surface that make it look like a pine cone. That's why it was called the pineal gland. The pineal gland is responsible for our circadian rhythms. Basically, you know, it knows when we are awake, it knows when we are asleep, and it helps us to achieve those states by switching melatonin on and off. But it also secretes many other important substances into our bloodstream. And so this is why it's fascinating to be able to see what happens when sound enters into our eyes, because when it does so, it travels straight through the eyeball, straight through the retina, because the retina is almost pure water as well. It obviously has protein content, but it's mainly water, right? Then it travels through the two optic nerves, which are a form of liquid crystal, which again is almost pure water. And then finally, the point where these two optic nerves converge is very close to the pineal gland, which sits in its own little sac of water, a fluid, very, very like water, and reaches the pineal gland finally. So when you make sound, that sound literally travels through your eyes and reaches the pineal gland. Now, what we are most interested in is the resonant properties of the sound versus the pineal gland. You know, so using this law, we can now identify exactly which frequency of sound will optimally stimulate the pineal gland.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and the pineal gland, by the way, I think it's fairly common knowledge that it's also been talked about historically as our third eye. And of course, also, again, I think fairly commonly known that it is our spiritual core, our spiritual the way that we connect with spirit, basically the divine energies of, as it were, of the universe, is via the pineal gland. So if we know how to optimally stimulate the pineal gland, we can help ourselves in many different ways. And one of them is because when the pineal gland is optimally stimulated, it helps to helps the immune system to destroy early stage tumors. So when a tumor is starting to grow in our body, and these happen all the time, by the way, you know, I don't think it's very commonly known that we all have cancer. We all have it all of the time, but generally it doesn't get a chance to take a hold because the immune system sees off, you know, literally destroys all of these rogue cells. And that is part of the process by which the pineal gland works. So being able to have an optimal stimulation of the pineal gland helps us to eradicate any rogue cells in our body, but also helps us to have a higher sense of spirit than we would have otherwise. So there you go.
That's a great, no, that's a great description, because it gives you a real visual representation, pardon the pun, about how this sound can heal, right? Because, I mean, sound healing, even in the last 5-10 years, has come a long way with acceptance. People are accepting it now, it seems like. But in the 2010s and the early 2020s, you know, it was still kind of woo, but now it's gaining some ground. But that's a really good visual of how that happens. So what frequencies are we talking about specifically for the pineal?
It turns out to be E3 on a piano, which ballpark is about 165 hertz, right? And some people might say, well, listen, my pineal gland might be a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller than the average pineal gland. Yes, that's certainly true, because, you know, people have different skull sizes. And of course, the glands in our body do vary a little bit in size, whether we're male, female, you know, and skull size and so on. But the good news here is, when you use musical sound, and I'm talking now about playing, let's say for argument's sake, you play E3.
Can I play an E3 now, quickly?
Oh, yeah, play it. Go ahead.
My phone says it'll do it. I don't know. We'll see.
That sound that you're playing there is not a simple single frequency, is it? It contains a whole bunch of harmonics, right? And so this is the good news, because when you play E3, you're not just getting that one single frequency of 165 hertz ballpark. It's a little bit, there's a few decimals involved as well, but essentially that's the center frequency. But then left and right of that, you've got a whole bunch of harmonics and subharmonics. So that's why when you play that musical note, it doesn't matter whether you're pineal gland is a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller. All of that is embraced, if you like, by those musical frequencies. And it's really very simple, but very beautiful.
Well, right away, it makes me think of like, doing that sort of thing for like, you know, is it healing? I mean, we've done a bunch of shows where people can chant all sort of stuff, and a lot of it is healing. Some of it is to enter different states of consciousness.
If you want to go off into that tangent, I can talk a long time about this subject. Okay, let's just take a short dive into that subject, because when you make vocal sound, lots of different mechanisms are triggered in the body. Even talking, by the way, which is what I'm doing right now, is helping to improve my what's termed vagal tone. We'll get to that in a minute. But much more simply, if I make a humming sound, and this is, by the way, a great friend of mine, Jonathan Goldman and Andy Goldman, wrote a whole book on this subject of humming, right? and how that helps to heal us. When you hum, those sounds actually resonate in your paranasal sinus cavities. Let me just take a little sip of water here. Your paranasal sinus cavities, but also your lungs. So then the deep notes of your hum will resonate your lungs between about 100 and 150 hertz, right? And the higher frequencies, in the ballpark 1,000 hertz to 2,000 hertz, will resonate your paranasal sinus cavities. And the differences, again, relate to body size, whether you're male, female, you might have a big body, you might have a small body. But, you know, within those ranges, you're going to be creating, when you make that humming sound, you're going to be resonating your lungs and your paranasal sinus cavities. Why am I sharing this? Well, because in both of those places in your body is where your body creates nitric oxide. Now, nitric oxide is perhaps the second most important molecule in the body in relation to healing. Oxygen is definitely the first, there's no doubt about that. But nitric oxide is a very good runner-up, because nitric oxide, one of its primary roles in the body is to create vasodilation. In other words, it relaxes all of your blood vessels, the walls of your blood vessels, and there dilates them, and therefore allows the passage of more blood. And of course, when you have more blood flowing in your bloodstream, you have more oxygen flowing in your bloodstream. So the two molecules really go hand in hand. And so many other wonderful effects occur because of nitric oxide. So it's not just vasodilation, One of the other effects is cytotoxic action, which means if you breathe in some pathogens, literally through your nose, and that is the best way to breathe, you're going to breathe pathogens, because the nitric oxide literally kills pathogens, stone dead, right? So that's a really another wonderful thing. It also helps with thrombotic events, in other words, blood clots. It reduces any potential for blood clots. And this is all coming just right from humming, right? That's such a simple thing. But one of the other wonderful aspects of humming or making any kind of vocal sound, whether it be, you know, singing or even just speaking as I am now, is in relation to the vagus nerve. Now, it should really be called the vagus nerves, plural, because there are two of them. When the vagus nerves leave the brainstem, the first place they go to, they branch off literally to our two ears. You know, scientific terms, it's called these are called the pinna of the ear or the auricle of the ear. Now, when you think about this in going way back to the evolution of Homo sapiens and even farther back to mammals, why we have to ask this question: why did nature arrange for the vagus nerves to go straight to the ears? Right? Great question, right? Because this vagus nerve has got nothing to do with our hearing. The auditory nerve, obviously, is the nerve that allows us to hear. The auditory nerve is connected to the two cochlea, the cochlea in left and cochlea right in our ears. That's how we hear, right? So why did the vagus nerve go completely separately to the pinna of the ear? Well, the answer, in my view, and this is hypothetical, by the way, because it hasn't been proven by scientists, but I can't think of any other logical reason for it, is that when this, if you think of your ears a little bit like parabolic dishes that are receiving sound in order that we can, collecting sound in order that we can hear better, right? If you didn't have your ears, you would struggle to hear. Actually, they do. They're wonderful collectors of sound. So that's the primary reason for so that we can hear. But the secondary reason, and this is the hypothetical part of it, is that it actually improves vagal tone. This is the ability of the vagus nerve system in your body to operate efficiently. And this is the reason why I believe nature has evolved to arrange it this way, so that the vagus nerve goes straight to the pinna of the ear. Now, from there, it then goes straight to the pharynx and the larynx. So first of all, when it goes to the pinna of the ear, this is really good news, because it means that we can stimulate our vagus nerve system through our ears. So now if you think about therapies where we're using sound as a therapy and we're wearing headphones, right? And now that's a really great, efficient way to get sound into the pinna or the auricle of the ear and straight down into the twin vagus nerves, right? Now, let me just tell you also a little bit about the vagus nerves in terms of why it's great for our health. One of the wonderful things about the vagus nerve is that if we have any chronic inflammation in our body, so I'm not talking about acute inflammation is necessary. If we injure ourselves, we have acute inflammation, and it's a very important part of the healing process in humans and in animals, right? But chronic inflammation? Well, chronic inflammation only occurs in the body usually because of some form of abuse. Either we have, well, I'm saying abuse. I mean, it can be simply toxic substances that we have imbibed somehow. And these toxic substances, by the way, can come from food that's being sprayed, you know, in certain ways, right? So it's not necessarily that we're literally, you know, in some chemical factory. No, we can get toxic substances into our body from the environment. And mostly, of course, it's the man-made environment. But however we've gained those toxic substances into our body, unfortunately, if it happens over a long period of time, we can have chronic inflammation in the body. Another way to get this situation of chronic inflammation is very severe physical trauma. I know many, many people, I've heard of many people, and I've met some of these people who have actually gone into a situation where there's chronic inflammation in the body because of some car wreck, right? Some crash of a car or some other kind of really bad physical trauma has shocked the body to such an extent that it goes into this situation, this downward spiral of chronic inflammation. What is chronic inflammation? Well, it's one of the ways to look at it is that in your bloodstream, you have two types of cytokines. These are little tiny parts of proteins, and they have a battle with each other. They're literally fighting each other, and that causes the chronic inflammation. In other words, the cytokines are not in balance with each other. Well, the very, very good news here, guys, is that if you optimally stimulate your vagus nerves, the chronic inflammation goes away because the cytokines come back into balance. And it doesn't take very long for this to happen. If someone has chronic inflammation, within about 3 weeks or so of really excellent vagal stimulation, that the cytokines rebalance and the chronic inflammation goes away. Now, it might surprise you to know that there is no medical cure available for someone with chronic inflammation, right? This is a fact. There is no medical cure. You could go to any MD with chronic inflammation, like say if you have a very severe case of fibromyalgia or some other autoimmune disease, and there's nothing that that doctor can give you other than a short-term boost of steroids or something, right? But nothing in the long term is going to fix you. And yet many, many researchers have discovered that optimal, and this is scientific studies that have been published, optimal vagal stimulation rebalances the cytokines and banishes the chronic inflammation. So you might be thinking, what I've always thought is, well, why are these wonderful medical discoveries not in the mainstream, right? And it's a really great question. And not so long ago, actually, it was last year, I was in Loveland, Colorado with the Shift Network. And I learned a very, very interesting fact that I didn't know. And that is that there's a 17-year gap between evidence and practice in medicine. 17 years it takes on average for a new scientific discovery to eventually make it into the mainstream and be embraced and used in mainstream medicine. Right?
Oh, so, it's a whole generation.
It is indeed, you know, and it's pretty shocking. I was really shocked when I learned that fact. But anyway, so that's, you know, one of the good news, little things about vagal stimulation. It helps us in so many different ways. And certainly in terms of chronic inflammation and the fact that we can banish it simply by listening to beautiful music. I'm not talking about, you know, weird sound frequencies here. I'm just talking about really beautiful music that we experience through our hearing, as long as we're wearing good quality headphones.
Or what about just your humming, like your normal humming? Is that enough to stimulate it? I mean, if yes. you did humming every day for a few weeks, like how long would you have to do it for? And how can we just dig into that just a little bit? Like you try and find that resonant frequency when you're humming?
Yeah, I'll tell you, humming would definitely help a lot, although I don't think many people would take it so seriously that they would do it, right? You know, it's far easier to stick on headphones, plug it into a music source and listen to music, which is a very pleasant thing to do instead of sitting there hour after hour humming, right? I mean, I'm not decrying humming. It's a really great thing to do. I just don't think from a realistic point of view that many people would actually take to that very easily. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so excited about this idea of stimulating the vagus nerve through music. But one of the aspects relating to what you've just asked there about humming is that it doesn't get down to the optimal frequencies that have been discovered by medical science. So in the various papers that have come out relating to how to optimally stimulate one's vagus nerve, the frequencies are in the range 5 to 10 hertz. So in other words, they are below the range of human hearing. And one of the ways that science, medical science, is trying to, well, trying to get this vagal stimulation to become popular is using electrical frequencies through the ears. So, you know, I talked about the fact that the vagus nerve goes straight to the ears. Well, you can put these little clips, little electrical clips on your earlobes, right, and plug them into an electrical device that stimulates your vagus nerve electrically. However, that is not, again, not very pleasant, right? Who would want to have their ears tingling, you know, for hour after hour? However, the beautiful thing here is that I made a discovery. It's called audio heterodyning. And it means that certain albums of music, when they are played, actually create in real time these very, very low frequencies in the range 5 to 10 hertz. Because you can't create those low frequencies with your own humming, that's for sure. You will still stimulate your vagus nerve pretty well, but not in the optimal range. And so this discovery that I made, this audio heterodyning, means that certain albums of music, when you play them through good quality headphones, when I say good, I'm talking about headphones that have a bottom frequency response of about 5 hertz. And there are many types, you know, many makes and models that do that, can achieve that. Then you're going to be receiving optimal vagus stimulation. And so if you are a person that has a really chronic health condition, might be chronic inflammation or some other chronic inflammation of situation in your body, then what could be better than listening to beautiful music through headphones, you know, just sitting there in a chair, reading or whatever you wish to do, watching TV even while you're listening to music, I suppose is possible. And then within a matter of weeks, all of that inflammation in your body just vanishes. You know, it's like, it's almost too good to be true, but it's true.
What are the evolutionary sort of scientists or biologists or whatever, what's like mainstream say, what's the reason for that vagus nerve to go through your ears and, you know, past your larynx? And what's the explanation for that? Because it seems to me like I can't come up with another reason for it other than sort of what we're talking about here. Like, was it, because it also begs the questions, like all these ancient cultures had drumming and chanting and all these different forms of music making, which, you know, tends to that they probably kind of knew what we're talking about.
Well, you would think so. I certainly think that drumming, I mean, I'd love to chat with you about drumming because there's another really wonderful mechanism in the body that we haven't touched on yet. But, you know, before we go there, just to, again, complete on this business of the vagus nerve, I cannot think of any other logical reason why nature arranged the vagus nerve to go straight to the pinna of the ear or the auricle of the ear, and then take it straight to the pharynx and the larynx, which, again, is very good news because, as we've been saying, just the act of making sound actually helps to support vagal tone. It helps to support the ability of the vagus nerve system to innervate, to connect with all of the major organs. So after the pharynx and the larynx, the vagus nerve goes to the lungs, goes to the heart, goes to the liver, the kidneys, and so on, to the gut, all of these different organs. And it's why, by the way, if you have a spinal cord injury, as you know, many, even some famous people have experienced, sadly, I'm thinking of Christopher Reeves here. If you have a spinal cord injury, you can still go on living, even though the motor parts of your body, unfortunately, you know, stopped functioning. All of the autonomic nervous system, you know, the fact that you can still breathe, you can still, your heart's still pumping blood around the circulatory system and so on. This is because of the vagus nerve, because the vagus nerve actually innervates the lungs, innervates the heart, innervates the gut and so on, right? That's why you can still live with a spinal cord injury.
That makes sense. Yeah. Do you want to? Oh, actually, we should probably just say before we move on to the drumming, Joe Valachi says in the chats, the vagus nerve might have something to do with ultrasonic hearing and other extended hearing range phenomena.
Well, that's a really interesting point, and I could talk all day about dolphins and their ultrasound hearing, because I've done a lot of research with dolphins and the cymoscope instrument. So that's another tangent we could go off on to. But let's come now to drumming, if we may.
Because,
you know, you were talking about, you know, ancient peoples, indigenous peoples, and it certainly brought up the idea of drumming to me. Well, I need to share with you a little story that started in 2018. And this is a story concerning Professor Sung Chul Ji of Rutgers University, U.S. He's now emeritus, but he was, you know, practicing professor at that time. And he came here to the lab invited. And, you know, one of the reasons for this connection was because I had given a scientific talk at a conference, another water conference, and he was there. And his son, Saya Ji, was there. Saya, by the way, is the owner of greenmedinfo.com, probably the world's largest natural health websites. But his daddy, Sung Chul, was there, and we met and had a good chat. Subsequently, he came here in 2018, and we worked together to create a protocol for a new experiment with human blood. And the design of this experiment was intended to prove, or hopefully prove, Pythagoras of Samos, who said 2,000 years ago or so, about 2,500 years ago, he said, music can be used in place of medicine, right? That was what his biographer wrote down, that he said those words. And so the experiment that I designed, and with the help of Professor G, we created a protocol for this experiment. In essence, it's very, very simple. You take a test tube of whole human blood and decant it into two smaller test tubes. One test tube goes into a very quiet area of the lab called the Faraday cage, which is electromagnetically screened, but also really very, very quiet in there. And the other vial of blood goes into another incubator in the lab where we have a speaker. So now we can play music to that blood. I think you can see where I'm going with this. So we have the control in the quiet environment, and we have the blood that's receiving music. What we then do is a blood count, literally of the red blood cells from both environments. And what we see, what we saw straight away with all different genres of music, was a significant increase in the viability of the red blood cells that were immersed in the music, right? And we were very happy about this, but we were actually scratching our heads as to what the driving mechanism was. You know, why does music have this amazing ability to increase the viability of the red blood cells? This viability word, by the way, simply means the ratio of living red blood cells to dead red blood cells. And so increases by about 15 to 18% with various genres of music that we tried. What was most surprising, guys, was that the poorest results came from classical music. And we we were really surprised at this. We actually, you know, intuitively thought, somehow, I don't know how, we thought that classical music would provide the best result. You know, it's very beautiful. It's usually very melodic, very slow. And so we assumed that blood would prefer that, let's say, to pop music, which has, you know, this usually pounding bass beat. But no, it didn't. And there were quite a few percentage points different between the classical music results and the popular music. So popular music was outshining classical music. So I'm going to cut this very short because it takes a long time to tell this full story. But the kernel of the story is that it is the bass beat of the music that actually causes the oxygen that's dissolved in the blood. And this oxygen, by the way, came from the donor. So literally, a donor gives blood, we get it here in the lab the very next day. So that the last breath that person took, male or female, obviously engorged the blood with oxygen. Then it's taken from the body by a phlebotomist. Then it's packed in ice, sent here. We warm it up. That blood contains lots of oxygen. But it turns out that that oxygen is not available to the hemoglobin molecules in the red blood cells. Why? Because there's no sound present. What you need in order for that oxygen to bind to the hemoglobin, you need pressure. And in the body, that pressure comes from every heartbeat. So, you know, everyone knows common knowledge that a heartbeat has a low frequency sound, right? What was not known until we conducted these experiments and finally figured out what's going on is it's the sound of the heartbeat that causes the oxygen to be bound to the hemoglobin. No sound, no heartbeat, no sound, no binding, right? So if your heart stops, you know what's going to happen. You would lose consciousness within a couple of seconds, right? And this is because...
So if I just keep playing a drum, could I keep someone alive? Is that as good as
CPR? You see where I'm going, right?
Better than CPR, right? Or maybe you should be doing CPR and have some motherfucker hitting the drum at the same time, too.
That's right. You've got it right away. You can see where I'm going with this. If your heart stops, you lose consciousness within about 2 seconds. Your brain is still, at that moment, your brain is still engorged with oxygen. All the blood capillaries and veins and so on in your brain are still filled with blood, still filled with oxygen, but suddenly it's not available to the hemoglobin because there's no more sound pressure from the heartbeat. It's that low frequency sound that causes that binding of the oxygen to the hemoglobin molecules, right? So that's why I'm talking now about these bass beats being so important in terms of that effect, and also drumming, which obviously so many indigenous cultures, you know, have engaged on over the millennia. Now you see why it is so energizing to the body. It's not just about the dancing, which in itself has many therapeutic effects because it moves lymph fluid around the body, for example. But now we know it also, the sound of the drum actually enters into your bloodstream in a very similar way to what your heart is doing. It causes the binding of oxygen to the hemoglobin. And then when you know, as I mentioned much earlier, that oxygen is the key molecule in the body for healing. So if you've got more oxygen in your body, you can heal better. Now imagine the scenario, guys, of a hospital of the future in which patients are receiving low frequency sound through their headphones, well, from music, right? Low frequencies via music through headphones, which is going to help any kind of chronic inflammation that the patient might have, and also generally stimulate their well-being because of the vagal stimulation. And at the same time, the bed itself that they're lying on has low-frequency transducers in it, and the sound is coming up, the low frequencies of sound are coming up through those transducers, through the mattress, into the patient's body, not in a kind of boring, dull, single-tone way, but in a rhythmic way, very like ocean waves that's kind of washing up and down the patient's body slowly by a bedside console where you can adjust the amplitude, you can adjust the rate of the waves, if you like, you know. Can you imagine that scenario in the future where hospitals are using sound as a healing tool instead of simply pharmacological substances? And so,
oh yeah, I love it. That's great. Well, we have like 15 minutes left. So what do we want to, do you want to mention your contraption, the cymoscope that you've got behind you there, or what would you like to talk about? Cause the other interesting thing that our listeners might really love is your experience in the pyramids that kind of led you to all this, but I don't know if we want to, you know, get into that. It's probably a longer story, but
I can briefly mention it because, you know, it was from that work in the pyramid that the cymoscope instrument had its genesis. That's where right. it was born in the Great Pyramid, right?
Well, and there's so much attention going on in the pyramids, and we went to Egypt a couple of years ago, so we should talk about that.
Sure. And yeah, I have heard all the chatter recently, by the way, about the scanning of the pyramids and so on, you know, so it is a subject that I'm obviously passionate about hobby, you could say. You know, I mean, my daddy and I visited Egypt many, many times, and we are a little bit more fortunate in some respects, you know, where we are located here in the UK, because we're a little bit closer, of course, than the US to Egypt. So it doesn't take very long for us to reach Egypt. Anyway, so it was in early 96 that my daddy and I were in the Great Pyramid alone. We had been in previously, but always with a gaggle of tourists, and they make so much noise. And, you know, when you're in that very highly reverberative space, you know, in the King's Chamber I'm referring to here in the Great Pyramid, you can hear a pin drop if you're quiet, right? But when people make sound with the, you know, vocal apparatus, oh my God, it just bounces around, and it's really, you know, it's a sacred space, and yet people just don't seem to respect that fact very often and make a lot of noise. Anyway, as it happened, very luckily, my daddy and I, in early 96, February 96, we found ourselves alone. And because I think it was toward lunchtime, and the way that the system worked then, I don't know how it works now, but then they sold a load of tickets in the morning and in the afternoon. So when the morning tickets were sold out, you couldn't get in, right, until the afternoon session started. And as it happened, when we got there, it was toward lunchtime. So I think everyone that had wanted to go in had gone in, come out, and there we were all alone. So what I did, guys, was I lay in the sarcophagus, this box of granite, basically 3.7 tons of rose-colored granite from Aswan. And this Aswan granite, by the way, has a very high quartz content. It's about 20% of the matrix in the stone is quartz, and that makes it highly resonant. And because at that time in my career, I was an acoustics engineer, I wasn't a scientist in those days. And so I was, you know, from an engineering perspective, acoustics engineering, I was really interested in the resonant properties of that sarcophagus, which is why I lay in it. My daddy was standing by watching silently, and I made a vocal glissando, and just to experience the sound of that wonderful little box. And at one particular vocal frequency, it felt like every cell in my body was tingling. And then what I did, a little experiment, I raised my vocal pitch above this, what I now call the Goldilocks zone, raised it above that, and the tingling stopped. I came down below it, and the tingling stopped. So right at that particular sweet spot, all the cells in my body felt like they were tingling, and goosebumps broke out all over my flesh. And so it was fascinating to me to play with that little sweet spot. And what the idea that crossed my mind was that this seemed to be designed. I thought it had been designed by the ancient Egyptians. And so I wanted to go back this time with acoustics instrumentation to actually measure the resonant properties of the sarcophagus. Well, I did that later that same year. I gained permission, and I carried out a series of, well, just very standard acoustics experiments, nothing hugely interesting, although there was one aspect that I could mention. But really, what I really wanted to do was a cymatics experiment, and I didn't have time in the 96 experiments, but I went back again in 97, and this time specifically for a cymatics experiment. So, you know, the principle of cymatics is really simple. Whenever sound is present and a membrane is present, there will be a pattern of acoustic energy imprinted on that membrane. And these membranes, by the way, I'm not talking about now like a membrane of latex or plastic or something. I'm talking about any surface. Literally around you is a form of membrane. And literally, as I'm speaking now, there will be beautiful patterns on the screen of my computer, right? Which you can't see with the unaided eye, right? But they're there nevertheless. And so in this case, with the sarcophagus, the idea was to stretch a membrane across the open top of the sarcophagus. And instead of me lying in it, now I placed a small speaker there so I could make sound into the sarcophagus from a little electronic oscillator, right? And so, and then the revealing medium, as you know, talk about how you make visible cymatic patterns. Well, there's various ways. One of them is literally powder, particulate matter, on a membrane. So in this case, the membrane was plastic. It was actually PVC. And the sand that we used came from outside the pyramid because they've got lots of sand in Egypt, you know. And that was the revealing medium that we use. It's a little bit like, I liken it to, you know, when you pick up a glass with your finger and thumb, you will create a fingerprint or a thumbprint on that glass. Well, both. But you won't be able to see it. And even if you know it's there, it's really hard to see. But if you sprinkle on some talcum powder, straight away, you can see that finger or thumbprint, right? Forensic science. Similar sort of principle with sound on a membrane. In this case, you sprinkle on a revealing medium, in this case, sand from outside the pyramid, and then you're making visible the resonances in the sarcophagus. And that was the whole design of the experiment. But what happened was, 3 weeks before going out to Egypt, I really badly injured my lower back to such an extent that I thought I wasn't going to be able to go and do this experiment. I was in such agony, and nothing that I did seemed to help it. You know, I went to a physiotherapist. I took lots of analgesic painkillers. Nothing seemed to touch this pain. And so anyway, in the end, I did manage to get myself to Egypt. Other people carried the equipment. And it's really difficult to get into the Great Pyramid if you
Yeah, that's a hobble up that shaft.
It really is. It's difficult. You have to bend forward. Well, in my case, I had what felt like a splint up my spine because, as I've later found out many years later when studying the physiology of spinal injuries, it's something called the splinting cycle. It's literally like your body creates a stiffness in your spine, in this case, to protect the site of the injury. I had done something really silly, guys. I had bent to one side and lifted something, and I really damaged muscles in my lower back. And then all of the other muscles in that area, they collaborate, you could say, and splint the area in order to protect it. And what happens when that occurs, it creates a lot of pain in your lower spine. So much pain, much more pain than the original injury. So I was in a lot of pain that day when I tried to get myself into the pyramid. But what I'm going to share with you now is really why I'm on this path that I'm on today in terms of, researching how sound and music support healing in the body. Because within 20 minutes of making sound in the King's Chamber, all of the pain left me. Now, something happened and never came back, by the way. That pain never returned. So it was a real healing. And it's not a miracle. You know, there's a scientific reason for this that I'm going to explain to you now. But before I do that, just to say that initially I was a little bit, put off the scent, you could say, by what had happened, because about 20 minutes into setting up this experiment, we started to see, the antiquities inspector and me, started to see ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs appear in the membrane stretched across this ancient sarcophagus, right? And this was like, oh my God, I don't believe this. You know, this is like, these things don't happen, but it was happening. And so the antiquities inspector, who initially had been standing up against the north wall, filing his nails and looking across at me with a very bored expression on his face and probably thinking this Englishman is a bit, you know, not quite right in the head, but he's paid all this money to come and do these experiments. So yeah, he's not doing any harm. You know, let's just let him do what he's doing. But now he saw this hieroglyph and it was large on the membrane and it was snaking, literally like writhing like a snake. And it was the backbone of the god Osiris. This is the Jed pillar, D-J-E-D pillar. And there it was, you know, in all its glory. And now he came running across from where he'd been standing. And his eyes were open like this. You know? And he'd say, how you do that? How you do that? And I just had to shrug my shoulders. I had no idea. I thought we were going to be seeing typical cymatic patterns, which are usually circular, usually symmetrical, and usually, you know, very, very beautiful to behold. This was actually a completely different scenario. Here we had a hieroglyph, and he recognized it. I recognized it. And now he was saying, well, how can I help you? What can I do? And so then we became a little team, right? And he would, you know, scrape off the sand off the membrane, and then I would be sprinkling on fresh sand with a cappuccino chocolate shaker, by the way. That's what I was using. And then start again with a new frequency. And then we would see another hieroglyph and another. Many different hieroglyphs occurred that day. And I photographed them, and we still, you know, we have the photographs to prove it. In those days, by the way, it was the very early days of digital photography. So I was using a film camera, because in those days, a high resolution digital photograph would be classed as 100 kilobytes. And I'm not exaggerating. That would be a, you know, high res, 100 kilobytes. Anyway, so I took a film camera. All of those, you know, films came out. They were all beautiful.
What were some of the other hieroglyphs?
Well, another one was called the Sa Loop, which is actually the hieroglyph for protection. And then we also saw that's a kind of a loop shape. Then we also saw the sun god, which is Ra, the sun god, is a circle inside a circle, and many, many others, very, very recognizable. You know, it wasn't like we had to stretch our imagination. There was also the sacred eye of Horus. Now, that is something that may relate to the pineal gland, because the ancient Egyptians were very good at dissecting bodies, and there's a lot of talk about the ancient Egyptians having knowledge of the pineal gland. So, and because it looks like an eye in cross section, you know, I've wondered about that. Anyway, I don't know whether that's true or not, but certainly many different hieroglyphs. And so when all of these hieroglyphs started to appear, obviously I was excited, right? You know, who wouldn't be under those circumstances? And I thought, when I noticed that there was no pain suddenly in my lower back, I thought, there are endorphins flowing in my bloodstream. These are natural opioids that actually help to mask pain when you're in a peak excitement, you know, peak experience. It takes you into a kind of euphoric state, and it mediates pain. And I thought, that's what's happening right now. I didn't have to worry about it. I just got on with the experiment. I felt so wonderful at the end of the experiment. I had no pain still. I was able to actually help to pack up the equipment, help to carry it out, right? It felt like a miracle at the time. And of course, that set me on this path that I'm on today.
Wow.
So in addition, of course, the other, as you mentioned about the cymoscope instrument, seeing these ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs said to me, if we can see ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs pop out on a membrane stretched across an ancient Egyptian sarcophagus, what else can the power of cymatics do, you know? And of course, that's why I ultimately designed and developed the cymoscope instrument. And now it's being used in universities all over the world for many different sciences. And so I feel really privileged and honored to have had that experience. So what turned out to be what I thought at the time was really something horrible that had happened to me, this back injury, turned out to be a great gift, not only for me, but for humanity, because now we are literally beginning to make bridges into mainstream medicine with sound therapy and with music medicine.
Because of the ability to visualize it. I mean, that really played a big part, because it's something tangible for everybody to see. This frequency makes this shape, you know?
That's right, yeah. But in addition to that, you know, the fact that I'd had that experience from the healing of my lower back meant that I've gone in this direction of understanding the biological reasons for this. And so in just a couple of years ago, I was invited to write a new chapter for a new medical textbook on these subjects. And that's gone now to thousands of medical doctors all over the world. And so, you know, the knowledge is being spread. It's burgeoning out into the world. And this is a really great thing.
I wonder which one, I'm not going to mention any names because I don't want to get anyone in trouble. But we were lucky enough to be alone in the King's Chamber. Not alone, but I did have some time alone in there and in the Queen's Chamber. But we were in there with a very dedicated group, and everyone was quiet, and everyone got a chance to go in the box, and there was a bunch of humming while we were in the box, so everyone sort of got a chance to experience that. I mean, it would be cool to do with the thing. Man, it makes me want to go back to Egypt and bring
What you're saying there, Darren, you know, brings to mind what I didn't share. I don't know if we've got any time left or not.
We got a couple minutes.
Okay, well, what I didn't share about the 96 experiments, and this is why you do want to go back, Darren. You do want to go back to the Great Pyramid, and I'll tell you why. Because in the 96 experiments, I had a small speaker again in the bottom of the sarcophagus, but this time, no membrane. What I was doing was exciting the sarcophagus with different frequencies of sound, and then I had what's called a measurement microphone, which is a calibrated microphone, picking up the sound from the same box, the same granite box, and then sending that signal into a spectrum analyzer in order to map the resonances of that granite box, right? That sarcophagus. That's what I was doing. And at one particular frequency, suddenly the sarcophagus became very excited. It was amazing what happened. It was suddenly extremely loud. This is because of pure resonance, right? And then when I try to shift the frequency a little bit above that area, suddenly the whole sarcophagus began to beat like a beating heart. Boom, boom, boom. And the antiquities inspector this time, he was still the same guy, by the way, as in 97. The antiquities inspector now, he rushed across again from where he'd been standing looking bored. And he was actually shocked. He thought I was going to damage the sarcophagus because it was very powerful, this sound. And it was, reverberating around the King's Chamber really powerful, really loudly. And it just sounded like a beating heart, guy. And actually, very recently, because of the Shift Network course, I have just written an article all about what's called rebirth symbolism in relation to the Great Pyramid. Because it turns out from mainstream Egyptology that the Great Pyramid was a resurrection machine. That's the term that's being used by Dr. René Friedman, who's a very senior Egyptologist, American Egyptologist. And so it's a resurrection machine. So I go into great detail in this article, which is actually being shared with the Shift Network members. And it all stems, in my case, from hearing the sarcophagus beat like a heart. And why I'm telling you, Darren, that this would be a great thing for you to do is because what I have now realized is that we could create this effect with vocal energy. So instead of having a speaker sitting in the bottom of the sarcophagus, now we've got a person there with a very good voice. And then around the sarcophagus, we've got other singers standing, can be a mixture of male and female, doesn't matter. And so the guy in the sarcophagus, might be you, creates this particular frequency that I've discovered. And then the other people, as soon as the sarcophagus gets really excited at your vocal frequency, then the other guys start chiming in with their voices at another very specific vocal pitch. And suddenly, can you imagine? The sarcophagus, boom, 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 boom.
Hopefully we don't break it. I mean,
that would be really exciting. I really want to do that. And I hope that we gain permission to do it.
Well, yeah, I mean,
great. Yeah. How do people find that article that you wrote? Where's that at?
That article is available through the Shift Network right now. If you register for this course, and the course,
that's the frequencymedicinecourse.com, right?
Yeah, that's it. frequencymedicinecourse.com. If you register now, you get that article free, and you get some other really tasty things as well. But that article, it's been a long time in gestation, and I've only just completed it after all these years. So I'm really excited about it. And you get that. I will ultimately, it will go into our shop ultimately after this course begins. And we have a shop, soundmadevisible.com. So, if you don't manage to go to the course, if you don't manage to register for the course, then ultimately you can get the article via our shop, soundmadevisible.com.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, this has been great. I mean, I feel like there was a bunch of tangents that we could have went down that we didn't.
And we're out of time and it's getting late over there, but I'll shoot you an email because I do have your email now and maybe we can do this again down the road. I feel like our audience is going to really resonate with this one. So
it's my favorite subject. So basically talking about, you know, sound therapy, music medicine, cymatics, all my and Egyptology, all my favorite subjects.
Thanks again. And come back anytime.
Many blessings. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye. All right. We will do the outro later. Put a note in your thing to do the outro while we do the intro. Yeah, thanks for listening, guys. We got another show to do that won't be on YouTube, but you can get it other places. Yeah, I'll catch you over there.
Five pink flamingos and a few flamenco dancers. They're in the kitchen and they're baking Day of the Dead cookies. And I step into the kitchen and I'm like, let me have a looky, see what kind of cookie you're cooking up. And they're looking up at me skeptical and I point next to my spectacles. And I'm wearing a maroon Harvard t-shirt. Yeah, I know I'm a smart cookie, but I'm no psychic. You can come and ring my bell. But where we're gonna end up in the future, I can never tell. I can never tell. Me and five of my best friends, and a few of my enemies. We're at the coffee shop. Settling our differences. Benjamin Otto pulls out a game of Chinese checkers and he orders a cappuccino. And I pick blue and he picks red and you pick yellow. And I'm wearing a tie-dye peace sign t-shirt. Yeah, I know I'm a peacenik, but I ain't no hypocrite. You can come and ring my bell. But where we're gonna end up in the future, I can never tell. I can never tell. One bell, one man. And with my sense of smell, I can smell the salt in your tears. I can sense your fears. You're hoping for a bit of divinity in this worldly vicinity. And you understand the fragility of the human vessel. And you sit Indian style like a pretzel. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate.